It was the year when they finally immanentized the eschaton. On April the 1st, the world's great powers came closer to nuclear war than ever before, all because of an obscure island named Fernando Poo. But while all other eyes turned to the UN building in apprehension and desperate hope, there lived in Las Vegas a unique person known as Carmel. His house was on Date Street and had a magnificent view of the desert, which he appreciated. He liked to spend long hours looking at the wild cactus wasteland, although he did not know why. If you told him that he was symbolically turning his back upon mankind, he would not have understood you, nor would he have been insulted. The remark would be merely irrelevant to him. If you added that he himself was a desert creature, like the Gila monster and the rattlesnake, he would have grown bored and classified you as a fool. To Carmel, most of the world were fools who asked meaningless questions and worried about pointless issues. Only a few, like himself, had discovered what was really important, money, and pursued it without distractions, scruples, or irrelevancies. His favourite moments were those, like this night of April the 1st, when he sat and tallied his take for the month, and looked out his picture window occasionally at the flat, sandy landscape, dimly lit by the lights of the city behind him. In this physical and emotional desert, he experienced happiness, or something as close to happiness as he could ever find. His girls had earned $46,000 during March, of which he took $23,000 after paying 10% to the Brotherhood for permission to operate without molestation by banana-nose Maldonado soldiers. This left a tidy profit of $20,700, all of it tax-free. Little Carmel, who stood 5'2" and had the face of a mournful weasel, beamed as he contemplated his calculations. His emotion was as inexpressible in normal terms as that of a necrophile who had just broken into the town morgue. He had tried every possible sexual combination with his girls. None gave him the frisson of looking at a figure like that at the end of a month. He did not know that he would have another $5 million and incidentally become the most important human being on earth before May the 1st. If you tried to explain it to him, he would have brushed everything else aside and asked merely,
"The 5 million. How many throats do I have to cut to get my hands on it?"
"But wait. Get out the atlas and look up Africa. Run your eyes down the map of the western coast of that continent until you come to Equatorial Guinea. Stop at the bend where part of the Atlantic Ocean curves inward and becomes the Bight of Biafra. You will note a chain of small islands. You will further observe that one of these is Fernando Poo. There, in the capital city of Santa Isabel during the early 1970s, Captain Ernesto Tequila Imota carefully read and reread Edward Luttwak's coup d'etat, a practical handbook, and placidly went about following Luttwak's formula for a perfect coup d'etat in Santa Isabel. He set up a timetable, made his first converts among other officers, formed a clique, and began the slow process of arranging things so that officers likely to be loyal to Equatorial Guinea would be on assignment at least 48 hours away from the capital city when the coup occurred. He drafted the first proclamation to be issued by his new government. It took the best slogans of the most powerful left-wing and right-wing groups on the island and embedded them firmly in a tapioca-like context of bland liberal conservatism. It fit Luttwak's prescription excellently, giving everybody on the island some small hope that his own interests and beliefs would be advanced by the new regime. And after 3 years of planning, he struck. The key officials of the old regime were quickly, bloodlessly placed under house arrest. Troops under the command of officers in the cabal occupied the power stations and newspaper offices. The inoffensively fascist, conservative, liberal, communist proclamation of the new People's Republic of Fernando Poo went forth to the world over the radio station in Santa Isabel. Ernesto Tequila y Mota had achieved his ambition, promotion from captain to generalissimo in one step. Now at last he began wondering about how one went about governing a country. He would probably have to read a new book, and he hoped there was one as good as Luttwak's treatise on seizing a country. That was on March the 14th. On March the 15th, the very name of Fernando Poo was unknown to every member of the House of Representatives, every senator, every officer of the cabinet, and all but one of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. In fact, the President's first reaction when the CIA report landed on his desk that afternoon was to ask his secretary,
"Where the hell is Fernando Poo?"
Saul took off his glasses and polished them with a handkerchief, conscious of his age and suddenly more tired than ever.
"I outrank you, Barney," he began.
Muldoon grinned.
"I know what's coming."
Methodically, Saul went on,
"Who on your staff do you think is a double agent for the CIA?"
"Robinson, I'm sure of, and Lerman, I suspect.
Both of them go. We take no chances.
I'll have them transferred to Vice Squad in the morning. How about your own staff?"
"Three of them, I think, and they go too.
Vice Squad will love the increase in manpower."
Saul relit his pipe.
"One more thing. We might be hearing from the FBI.
"We might indeed."
"They get nothing."
"You're really taking me way out on this one, Saul."
"Sometimes you have to follow your hunches. This is gonna be a heavy case." "Agreed?"
"A heavy case,"
Muldoon nodded.
"Then we do it my way."
"Let's look at the fourth memo,"
Muldoon said tonelessly.
They read, "Illuminati Project, Memo 4, 7/24, JM. Here's a letter that appeared in Playboy a few years ago. The Playboy Advisor. Playboy, April 1969, pages 62-64. I recently heard an old man of right-wing views, a friend of my grandparents, assert that the current wave of assassinations in America is the work of a secret society called the Illuminati. He said that the Illuminati have existed throughout history. Own the international banking cartels, have all been 32nd degree Masons, and were known to Ian Fleming, who portrayed them as Spectre in his James Bond books, for which the Illuminati did away with Mr. Fleming. At first all this seemed like a paranoid delusion to me. Then I read in the New Yorker that Alan Chapman, one of Jim Garrison's investigators in the New Orleans probe of the John Kennedy assassination, believes that the Illuminati really exist. Playboy, of course, puts down the whole idea as ridiculous, gives the standard Encyclopedia Britannica story that the Illuminati went out of business in 1785. Pat. Price Fixer stuck his head in the cafeteria door.
"Minute,"
he asked.
"What is it?"
Muldoon replied.
"Peter Jackson is out here. He told the associate editor I spoke to on the phone. He just told me something about his last meeting with Joseph Malik, the editor, before Malik disappeared."
"Bring him in," Muldoon said. Peter Jackson was a black man, truly black, not brown or tan. He was wearing a vest in spite of the spring weather. He was also very obviously wary of policemen. Saul noted this at once and began thinking about how to overcome it. And at the same time he observed an increased blandness in Muldoon's features, indicating that he too had noted it and was prepared to take umbrage.
"Have a seat,"
Saul said cordially.
"And tell us what you just told the other officer."
"With the nervous ones, it was sound policy to drop the policeman role at first and try to sound like somebody else, somebody who, quite naturally, asks a lot of questions." Saul began slipping into the personality of his own family physician, which he usually used at such times. He made himself feel a stethoscope hanging about his neck.
"Well,"
Jackson began in a Harvard accent,
"this is probably not important. It may be just a coincidence."
"Most of what we hear is just unimportant coincidence,"
Saul said gently.
"But it's our job to listen."
Everybody but the lunatic fringe has given up on this by now,
Jackson said.
It really surprised me when Joe told me what he was getting the magazine into.
He paused and studied the two impassive faces of the detectives. Finding little there, he went on reluctantly.
It was last Friday. Joe told me he had a lead that interested him, and he was putting a staff writer on it. He wanted to reopen the investigation of the assassinations of Martin Luther King and the Kennedy brothers.
Saul carefully didn't look at Muldoon, and just as carefully moved his hat to cover the memos on the table.
"Excuse me a moment,"
he said politely, and left the cafeteria. He found a phone booth in the lobby and dialed his home. Rebecca answered after the third ring. She obviously had not gotten back to sleep after he left.
"Saul?"
she asked, guessing who would be calling at this hour.
"It's gonna be a long night," Saul said. "Aw, hell."
"I know, baby. But this case is a son of a bitch."
Rebecca sighed.
"I'm glad we had a little ball earlier this evening. Otherwise, I'd be furious."
Saul thought, suddenly, of how this conversation would sound to an outsider. A 60-year-old man and a 25-year-old wife. And if they knew she was a whore and a heroin addict when I first met her.
"Do you know what I'm going to do?"
Rebecca lowered her voice.
"I'm going to take off my nightgown and throw the covers to the foot of the bed and lie here naked, thinking about you and waiting."
Saul grinned.
"A man my age shouldn't be able to respond to that after doing what I did earlier."
"Oh, but you did respond, didn't you?"
Her voice was confident and sensual.
"I sure did. I won't be able to leave the phone booth for a couple of minutes."
She chuckled softly and said,
"I'll be waiting."
"I love you,"
he said, surprised, as always, at the simple truth of it in a man his age. "I won't be able to leave the phone booth at all if this keeps up," he thought.
"Listen,"
he added hurriedly,
"let's change the subject before I start resorting to the vices of a high school boy. What do you know about the Illuminati?"
Rebecca had been an anthropology major with a minor in psychology before the drug scene had captured her, and she fell into the abyss from which he had rescued her. Her erudition often astonished him.
"It's a hoax," she said.
"A what?"
"A hoax. A bunch of students at Berkeley started it back around 66 or 67.
No, that's not what I'm asking. The original Illuminati in Italy and Spain and Germany in the 15th to 18th centuries, you know?
Oh, that's the basis of the hoax. Some right-wing historians think the Illuminati still exist, you see? So these students opened up an Illuminati chapter on campus at Berkeley and started sending out press releases on all sorts of weird subjects so people who want to believe in conspiracies would have some evidence to point to. That's all there is to it. Sophomore humor."
"I hope so," Saul thought.
"How about the Ishmaelian sect of Islam?"
"It has 23 divisions, but the Aga Khan is the leader of all of them. It was founded around, 1090 A.D., I think, and was originally persecuted, but now it's part of the Orthodox Muslim religion. It has some pretty weird doctrines. The founder, Hassani Sabir, taught that nothing is true and everything is permissible. He lived up to that idea. The word assassin is a corruption of his name."
"Anything else?"
"Yeah, now that I think of it, Sabir introduced marijuana to the Western world from India. The word hashish also comes from his name."
"This is a heavy case," Saul said.
"And now that I can walk out of the phone booth without shocking the patrolman in the hall, I'll get back to work on it. Don't say anything that'll get me aroused again. Please."
"I won't. I'll just lie here naked and..."
"Goodbye."
"Goodbye,"
she said, laughing. Saul hung up, frowning. Goodman's intuition, the other detectives call it. It's not intuition. It's a way of thinking beyond and between the facts, a way of sensing holes, of seeing that there must be a relationship between fact number one and fact number two, even if no such relationship is visible yet. And I know. There is an Illuminati, whether or not those kids at Berkeley are kidding. He came out of his concentration and realized where he was. For the first time, he noticed a sticker on the door. "This phone booth reserved for Clark Kent." He grinned. An intellectual's kind of joke, probably somebody on the magazine. He walked back to the cafeteria, reflecting. Nothing is true, everything is permissible. The doctrine like that, people were capable of... He shuddered. Images of Buchenwald and Belsen, of Jews who might have been him. Peter Jackson looked up as he re-entered the cafeteria. An intelligent, curious black face. Muldoon was impassive as the faces on Mount Rushmore.
Mad Dog, Texas, was the town where Malik thought these assassins had their headquarters,
Muldoon said.
That's where the staff writer was sent. What was the staff writer's name?
Saul asked.
George Dorn,
Muldoon said.
He's a young kid who used to be an SDS, and he was once rather close to the Weatherman faction.